Hello there, and welcome to the Theater People Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Hines.
You are not Patrick Hines. You're Mo Brady, and I'm Nika Graf Lanzaroni, and we are from The Ensemblist.
Nope, I am most definitely Patrick Hines.
You don't even sound like Patrick. Patrick sounds authoritative, but kind. You sound like you're always about to belt
this
defy
gravity.
This is
Patrick Hines, and listeners, I invite you to join The Ensemblist at 54 Below on September 13th, where they will be
We will be sharing backstage stories from Broadway's St. James Theater with some of the incredible actors who have performed there. In addition, Greg Young and Tom Myers of the Bowery Boys podcast will be sharing some of the theater's little-known history and how it fits in with New York City.
Plus that Mo Brady will be there, and he is super handsome.
Get your tickets now at 54below.com.
Well, that part's true.
Yeah, I'm Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I'm Celia Keenan-Bolter. This is Queen Leslie.
I'm Robin DeJesus.
I'm Erin Davey.
Hi, this is Ellen Marie Marsh.
I'm LaShawn.
I'm Telly Leung.
Hi, I'm Eden Espinosa.
I'm Laura Osnes.
I'm Katie Finneran.
Hi, I'm Tanya Pinkins.
I'm Karen Olivo, and you are listening to the Theater People Podcast.
Hello, fellow theater people. Welcome to the Theater People Podcast. I'm Patrick Hines, your host. Every now and then, an unknown actor makes such a startling, completely unexpected star-making Broadway debut that the industry can't help but stop and take notice. That's what happened this past season with today's guest, Geneva Carr, who is currently starring, in a role that was written for her, I might add, in the Broadway production of Hand to God. Producer Mike and I initially saw the show in previews in preparation for our interview with one of the show's other stars, the great Mark Kudisch. Mark is amazing in the show, of course, but as the house lights came up at intermission, Mike and I both furiously tore into our playbills, asking the same question. Who is that woman giving that gut-wrenching, hilarious, insanely human performance as Marjorie, the main character's mother? Over the course of her many years playing the part, in workshops, off-Broadway, and on-Broadway, Geneva has been nominated for just about every award under the sun, including the Tony Award for Best Leading Actress in a Play. I actually thought she was going to win that. She's made commercials with Beyoncé and Kevin Bacon, she's guest starred on more than 15 network TV shows, and she just landed herself a pilot on TV Land. This woman is amazing. We were so thrilled to meet her and chat with her. Here's our conversation. First of all, Geneva Carr.
Hi.
Welcome to the Theater People
Thank
Podcast.
Thank you.
Mike and I first saw Hand to God because we were having Mark Kudisch on the show.
Oh, I love Mark Kudisch.
So
he's
great.
Insane.
Totally. But then I was like, but we have to get her too. She's so good. I was going to say, normally what we'll do, like our format is sort of like, let's talk about your current project and then like go back to the beginning. Uh-huh. And I wanted to say with you, I kind of wanted to go chronologically and talk about sort of how you ended up an actor in the first place.
Oh, it's
you
so
have this
odd.
Like really interesting story about like going to school for finance.
Yeah. In Paris.
Right. And you went to Mount Holyoke here and then you
I went,
went
to Mount Holyoke and then I went to ESCP in Paris. And you know, again, the choices that we make in life, they were based on money. I mean, I had no money. MHC, Mount Holyoke, gave me the scholarship. So I was like, oh, I guess I'll go there. And then there was one scholarship to study France abroad, just one. And I was like, well, I want to study abroad. I'm broke. I'm going to study French. And I got it.
So you went to study French in France?
No, at Mount Holyoke.
And then I
went my junior year abroad. And then I thought, oh, I like this Paris thing. And I haven't got a dime to my name. What could I do? And the most expensive exclusive schools in France at the time were $3,000 a year.
Oh, my
I went
goodness.
To the top of, you know, the top of the line, like the Harvard of Paris. And it was $3,000 a year. So I took out one student loan. I had to get their school approved by the U.S. government to be a graduate program so that I could get, you know, the $7,500 loan. But I paid for 2 years. And I taught English while I was there. And, I mean, so many of life's choices are, well, you know, I want to live in a foreign country. How am I going to get there?
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And I was studying finance. And it was very interesting. And then I couldn't get my papers after I graduated. So my company, which is Société Générale, which you may have heard of.
What's it called?
Société Générale. It's a big French bank. It's the black and red logo, if you've ever seen any of the French banks. So they transferred me to New York to get my papers going. And I was selling derivatives. And if you care what a derivative is, that's not that interesting. anyway, I'll tell you later. It's not that good. But so I got transferred on this job that was short term. And I got, this is so bizarre, but I got some mail that was sent to me to Mount Holyoke. And of course, I'd been in France for 3 years. So I open all this mail. And this guy who had done a workshop in my high school for you know, why playwriting is important for children, why teaching them playwriting, not grammar, but let them write what they feel, had written a book about kids, and I was in the book. But of course, he said, come to my book signing, and it was 3 years prior, and I look at his address, and he's my neighbor in New York.
Oh my God.
So I go knock on his door. This is Daniel Judah Sklar. He's a teaching artist. He teaches all over the country, but he's based in New York, and he's a writer. And I call him up, and we chit-chat, and he says, oh, hey, I'll take you to see a play at EST. Now, this was EST in the 90s.
That's Ensemble Studio Theater.
Ensemble Studio Theater, mm-hmm. which I'm going to say it politely, but it was a shithole.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still an amazing shithole now. It's like the most creative, interesting. They develop all new work. It's fascinating. But I'd never seen a crack vial, and I was obsessed with Barbie as a child, and I thought, oh, that looks like a thermos for Barbie. And my friend said, don't pick that up. That is a crack vial, Geneva.
Ensemble Studio Theater?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was, you know, listen, it's cleaned up its act. It's doing really well. There's, you know, Le Bergamot on the corner, a little French cafe.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they've gone through some rough times. And so we go to see this play there. And I had never, I'd seen a couple of plays, I'd been in a couple of plays in high school, you know, Arsenic and Olays, where you draw on the wrinkles. But to see just amazing actors living on stage and telling a story, it's such a different medium from film and television, where you watch people living in front of you and you are the fourth wall and you're in it. So it's not passive entertainment.
Right.
It's more visceral. You can't grab a snack and run to the bathroom. You're in it. And I hadn't ever seen that. And it just blew my mind. And then, you know, we got to meet the actors. And I just, it so astounded me of what it was. And I thought, well, I want to do that. And he said, oh, take an acting class. So I took an acting class with Chris Sarasso. And that was beginning acting. That was where, you know, oh, the coffee is hot. Hold the hot coffee. Smell the hot coffee. And he said to me, why are you in here? Haven't you, you're an actor. Oh, I am, really. I'm a derivative sales rep. So I took a class with Jane Hoffman, who is literally the woman who changed my life. I'm taking these acting classes with her, coming after banking. And she says, okay, everybody bring a headshot because I have an agent coming next week. And I said, oh, I don't have a headshot. I'm a banker. I'm just doing this for fun. And she said, you're old. You're getting older every day. Bring me a headshot next week or stop wasting my time and don't waste your own.
Oh, my God.
I was 28, 29. I mean, that's old.
Yeah.
And she taught me how to act. And she, I guess, she also taught me that you live once. Mm-hmm. I remember I was turning, you know, I'd just become an actor and I was turning 30. And I thought, oh, am I ever going to make it? I'd laugh at that statement now. But, oh, am I ever going to make it? And she said, listen, life is a journey. You may never get there. If you're not happy getting there, quit.
Oh, my God.
And it's such a life lesson that we all have dreams and goals. And somebody said to me about the show today, you know, what would you like to happen? And I fantasize in specifics. And I said, I would like us to run to sold out houses through March and then go to London.
Yes.
And win some Olivier's. I mean, that's really
what I want. Yeah.
That's how I think. And he said, oh, that's a great fantasy. And I live that way, but you have to enjoy the day to day. And the show that now you guys have seen twice is such an exciting ride. For an actor, there's not a possibility to phone anything in.
Right.
I've been doing this show since 2011 on and off, and it is still a learning experience. I come off stage and I've figured something out, or I understand a line differently, or it's just new, and especially the actors that I'm working with are astounding.
I thought this when I was doing the research for this episode. What was, when you saw the show, you decided you wanted to be an actor, now you're super successful, but like, what was the very next thing you did? Did you quit your job and start taking acting classes, or were you doing them both at the same time?
That is a great question, and I feel like you should always tell actors, because there's a million ways to skin a cat.
And that's kind of what like we try to get into on this show, because we have a lot of young people who listen to this who are breaking into the business, and so many people who've been on the show have gotten into it so many different ways. So you have such a fascinating story that always think, like, has anyone asked you, like, what did you do when you went home that night? Like,
No, but that's a great question. And again, because I'm Miss Practicality, backstage.
Backstage
I went and got Backstage Magazine, and I looked for work. And I found paying work in backstage. I mean, you do have to have, you know, your hackles up if anybody says take off your clothes for something, obviously.
Right. We're going to ask you to do that later, but it's legit.
I'm half naked already. I'm happy to do it for you. It's radio. I can't wait to be naked. But I did take acting classes. I had to make sure I had a job, so I switched banking jobs and I started working for a French company. And of course, I mean, that was literally within 2 weeks that I found another job with a French company, because by noon our time, France is asleep, their day's over. So I took acting classes in the afternoon. And I would say to the American office, oh, I'm on an errand. And then I would come back that night and finish my job. So I worked for about a year and a half after I decided to be an actor. I took acting classes with Jane Hoffman. And here's my real trick. I went and got Ross reports. Now, I didn't target agents, and I tell actors that is not the way to do it. I mean, I realize you can find your own way, but they don't hire you. What you need to do is get in touch with casting directors. So I found the Ross reports. At the time, you could do mailings. I'm certain you can do the same thing now. I never did a mailing without at least five responses. My letter was brief. My letter was funny. I used to say, I'm the girl next door with a screw or two loose. Call me. And then I wrote any major casting director and said, I'm a terrific reader for your auditions, and I'm affordable. In fact, I'm free. Call me. So I did stage directions for people like, you know, Playwrights Horizons. I did it for all the networks. Anybody who would call me to read stage directions, big casting director or small, I did it because you get in the door that way. If you can be discreet and reliable, they will never forget you.
Oh, reliable is like the key word.
In this business, yeah. If you say yes, you're going to do it. I mean, you have to do it. I've said yes to, you know, commercial extra work and then gotten a call back, and I had to go to the commercial extra work. If you give your word, you give your word.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I think that as actors, we forget that. I'm going to tell you this because I don't care. The Tonys. I got an interview by this guy to do my dress. Thea, this incredible dress company. And then Anna Wintour said, oh, you know, I want you to wear my stuff. And
Anna Wintour came to you?
Well, Anna Wintour. Her people come and they go to, you know, Lisa, my publicist, Lisa Goldberg, who's unbelievable.
Ooh, we love her on the show.
Love her. Yeah. Love her. She's my rock.
Yeah.
And so, you know, then they ask and, you know, you'd given your word. And that means something. And so she said, no, Geneva gave her word and she's wearing someone else. And people have to respect that. Listen, she did give me the rundown at the Tonys and gave me the stink eye. But I don't...
Wintour?
Yes.
Come on, Anna.
I was sitting next to the Proenza Schooler boys and she gave me the stink eye.
Oh, my God.
But I went right up to him and I said, hey, listen, you didn't dress me. You could have.
Did you say that to Anna Wintour?
No, I said it to Schooler. Oh. And he said, yeah, Proenza boy. And I said, yeah, you could have. And he said, oh, well, you know, you should have contacted me. I said, I did, but your press people didn't respond.
Oh,
and then I said, can we get a selfie? The Hollywood Reporter is following me today. Sure, he said, sure. You just have to be honest and direct. But, you know, that's a side story. But in any event, starting out, I think the best way is to get in touch with casting directors. And, you know, there's a way to do it politely. Listen, all the Law and Orders, they all have a box outside their casting office. They actually look through those. I cannot tell you. I was actually making a living acting before I got an agent. Because agents... they are the most amazing negotiators, but it's hard for them to search for work for you. You know, and how I explain that to actors is they get 10% of your income. Let's say you make $100,000 a year. For an actor, that's a great living.
Yeah.
Your agents are getting 10.
Right.
That's not anybody's salary. They got to pay people to photocopy, people to answer the phone. That's not money. It's good money to you, but it's the big fish that bring in the money to them. So you have to treat them like they're getting 10% of your income. You do 90%. They do 10. Stop thinking an agent's going to make your life amazing. My agents are astounding. I've had my first and only agents. I was making a living acting. The first professional job I did was a job at Playwrights Horizons. I did Betty Summer Vacation.
Yeah.
And Chris Durang. And at the opening night party, someone said, oh, she's great. Who's she with? And James Caleri said, nobody. And that's how I got Abrams.
Wow.
Yeah. But I say to actors, stop thinking an agent's suddenly going to change your life, because you have to do it. Even if you made $100,000 a year, $10,000 isn't going to make them work that hard. They can't. They can't afford it.
Right.
So you have to... readings. That's the other thing. I also went up to anybody. I went to EST, which is where I saw that show. And I went to anybody who was anybody and said, hey, I'm really good at stage directions. So every time I did stage directions, it turned into a job. And again, you got to be reliable. You got to be discreet. Young actors sometimes think the best way to get attention is being big. The best attention is small attention. If you show up on time and you're polite and you're good at your job, they will notice you.
Is that what you mean by discreet?
Yeah. A lot of times, like I used to coach, and a lot of actors would walk into auditions and want to shake hands. You never do that. If somebody wants to shake your hand, let them come to you. But it sounds crazy. But the less attention you need, the more reliable you are.
Yeah.
And that's really what they need, because if you come in and you do your job and you're good, believe me, they remember you. But if you come in and you're loud and you're broad and you're funny and you're shaking everybody's hand and you're making jokes, it's a lot to deal with. And actors are actually just a tiny part of the puzzle. You know, I do so much other work. I do lots of commercials.
I was going to ask you about that. It seems like early on you had a lot of success with commercials and TV work.
Yeah, I mean, I still do. It's my bread and butter. I mean, commercials I love, and that's actually my training. That was the best training, because commercials are 30 to 60 second movies starring me. And you learn so much. You learn about not just the camera and how to relax in front of it, which sounds crazy, but again, you have to remember your place. And that sounds odd, and it sounds like old lady advice, but as a young actor, actors always think you have to be special and unique to get noticed. Truthfully, you just have to do your job well, and you will get noticed. That's how the world actually works. And I know from being on commercial sets and film sets, you want to just be as easy as possible, because you're going to get tough personalities. You know, it's funny. I just did this amazing campaign with Kevin Bacon for the American Egg Board. It's one of the funniest spots I ever shot. And the day before we did this spot, we rehearsed with the director. And the director said, yeah, we're going to rehearse. And you and I, and we don't, because it was me and the husband. And he said, we just don't know how Kevin's going to be. Because the truth is, when you get a major celebrity, they could be difficult.
Yeah.
Although I'll tell you, like Beyonce, easiest person you ever worked with in your life.
You've worked with Beyonce?
Shot a commercial with that woman. You will not meet a kinder, less difficult. She was doing her own touch-ups in the car, and at one point I was like, no, we need water. Beyonce must be thirsty. And she was like, are you thirsty? I was like, yeah, but aren't you thirsty? And she said, yeah, let's get you water. I mean, but the hardest working, never drew attention to herself. She, total team player. Unbelievable.
I love that.
The nicest. I mean, it's just astounding. And so, you know, Kevin Bacon, we rehearsed before him the day before, and the director says, we don't know what he's going to do. Show up, playful, funny, kind. It's true, you never know, but on a job like that, as an actor, you have to know, you got to suck it up, and because I have worked with people who are difficult. You have to suck it up and take whatever they give you and be quiet. And you know, it was going to be the Kevin Bacon show. And it turned out he is just, aside from being an astounding actor, the most generous, Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Unpretentious. It was like hanging out where we are right now.
Wow.
And so it was a great day. But that's what you have to prepare for. And so when you work with a lot of stars, that's what they tell you. So in commercials, they always warn you. And I always say to people, you know, I did 11 spots for AT&T for these orange rollover minutes. I don't know if you ever saw those.
Yeah.
Whose are these? Yeah. You're still good, young man. And I say to people, especially young actors, the star of that commercial was the orange rollover minute. In between takes, the guy who would wipe it down and make sure it was ticking and that it didn't glare, that was the star. They did not care about me. And the minute you know that, you're cool with it, because I certainly didn't go into the business to be a star. I just want to be a part of a team, you know?
God, I could just listen to you talk for a day. You have the best stories.
Oh, you're so sweet.
Well, okay, let's talk about how... Is it true that this play was sort of written for you?
It was written for Steve and me, with the two of us in mind.
Steve Boyer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Steven, amazing Boyer.
I call him Steve. I don't know him, but Steve. I'm Steve.
You know, he doesn't know if he goes by Steve or Steven, and I call him both, and he's happy with it. The amazing Robert Askins was someone that we knew from EST. Now, EST has another writing group that's part of their company called Youngblood. And Youngblood is a program that develops writers under 30. And how they do it is they say, hey, we're going to write plays, and we're going to – everybody just make up names of titles, and we'll draw them out of a hat. And so they would draw the title of a play out of a hat. They would draw names of actors out of a hat. It's just actors that volunteered to do new work. And then the name of a director. And then they would write plays for people. And I met Rob doing this, and that's how Steve met him as well.
Are you serious?
And the first play I did for him was called Matthew and the Pastor's Wife. John Giampietro directed, Scott Sowers was in it, and it was about a man who was cheating on his wife, and he couldn't stop, so he went to the pastor's wife for counseling. And she realizes that she cannot control his urges, and the only way to do it, she seduces him, and then she sews his mouth shut on stage. So I was having sex with this guy, and I sewed his mouth shut on stage.
Oh, my God.
It was gory and insane and funny, and all the themes that Rob loves to play with, that's how they develop work. They say, write whatever you want. Here are a couple actors. Here's a title.
So you guys literally got paired by chance.
By chance. And that's how I met him. And then, you know, we're in this writing group, and he said, I just liked those two, and I wanted to do something for them. He wrote that play. He wrote Hand of God in 2 weeks. And he called us up and said, hey, I'm going to do a reading of this play, and I want you guys in it. And there's a puppet, but I'm going to bring an oven mitt so that Steve can have a puppet. So Steven Googles easiest puppet to make, which is sock puppet.
Of course.
And he had done a show by Nick Jones with puppets that resembled Balinese shadow puppets, which have these arms. And so Steve made these weird arms with hangers, you know, wire hangers.
Wait, he invented that?
He invented the look of Tyrone, an amazing artist, Marta, whose name I can't pronounce, she's Norwegian, developed the, you know, our Tyrone now. But the original Tyrone, I think I have pictures of him in my phone. He's like a dirty old tube sock with some lipstick and some eyeshadow.
And it was Steven's idea to have it on the arms on the sticks.
And from the first read-through, so we actually did it, I'll never forget it, we did it in the basement of Pace University. There were a few of us there, maybe 10 friends watching, and we read it cold. And from the minute we did that reading, there were two people. I was talking to Jason and his puppet Tyrone, and Steve is one of the most facile. His mind is so quick, but his body is so quick, and he was doing the puppet. And, you know, he's right-handed, and Tyrone is on his left.
Right.
Because he wanted to be able to do these moves with Tyrone's arms. Like, I don't know if you noticed that, you know, in the show, Tyrone does these things like this when he sings, Jesus.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, the other day I said, I think he gave me the stink eye. And Steve was like, Geneva, those are buttons. And I said, no. He kind of squinted at me and gave me the stink eye. Because Steven does these things with his knuckles that makes Tyrone's face move. I mean, from the first read-through, it was like that.
I want to quickly, I want to read this little synopsis of the play so that for anybody who doesn't know it, we'll probably go over this in the introduction.
I'll do my own synopsis.
Will you? I was going to ask you because mine is terrible.
Oh, well, I'll tell you. This is a play about a mother and a son dealing with the death of her husband and his father. And in order to find solace, they go to the church and the pastor there for help. And he advises her to start a Christian puppet ministry for teenagers. And her son's puppet gets possessed by the devil. Or not.
Maybe we don't know.
And everyone in the play has their own demons. And it's how we face our demons and how we express them.
I'm so curious to talk about the husband that died.
Yeah.
So can you tell me your initial reaction when you read the play the first time? Or when you were a part of that initial read-through?
That initial read-through, I don't know how. Rob's writing is so honest, and it comes from a very true place. Rob did lose his father at 14. His mother did start a Christian puppet ministry.
And those are a real thing, apparently.
Oh, in the South, I'm from the South, Christian puppet ministries are huge. They aren't usually told with sock puppets. They almost look like Muppets in a way.
Uh-huh. What is the point of them?
Oh, the I point don't mean is that to tell Bible stories. No, okay. It's a great way to get kids' attention. You tell Bible stories with puppets. So it's puppet theater, but with, you know, Jesus themes and stories from the Bible. And it's very popular in churches because kids love to do it.
Oh my God.
There are tons of books written about this. The books that actually I have on stage are books about puppet ministry for, you know, Christian children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. One of the quotes is, if your hand finds something it likes to do, then keep doing it. And I have highlighted that section. And I, sometimes when I'm on stage flipping through and supposedly working, I see that. And I just don't know how I can go forward.
When did you know that this play had legs? Because it had several. I believe you're on your fourth incarnation of it
we
now.
We did
right?
five readings of this play. And every time we did it, it was funny.
Yeah.
It's always funny. And then I remember we were in the Southampton Writers Conference, which EST used to go to, and they what they would do is they would bring actors so that Emily Mann, who has a writing group there, we could just read cold. So every morning you would read new work from people who were 18 to 70. It was amazing. They don't do that anymore. But at this point in 2011, we did this reading. They said, oh, you can bring your actors and you can do a reading. And they invited Moritz von Stippnagel to direct. And, you know, we had an afternoon of rehearsal with him. And that's when I knew we had something deeper than anyone had understood, because I'd done so many readings. I'd had a different Pastor Greg every time. I'd had a different Timmy. They were all fantastic. But Steve and I were the only people who did it every single time. And we did this reading with Moritz, and it was so funny. But it was also so heartfelt and true. And Moritz sacrificed jokes to make sure that we were telling the story of a mother and a son who had lost each other and a woman who'd lost her faith and how they reconnected, how he was expressing himself through the puppet, she was expressing herself in other ways, and they had to own up to who they were and reach out to each other. And it was so moving. You know, we are out there doing a tragedy.
Yeah.
Two people are laughing, but we are giving it all the drama it's worth.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so funny.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew we had something special. And I think everybody did, because we did, the reading was maybe for 125 people, and the audience went banana pants. And I
thought, I love it.
I thought, we have something. And that's when we did a showcase of it. In the fall, you know, where you get tokens, or not tokens anymore, now you get a Metro card.
Oh, yeah.
We did that, and then it became a mini contract. And Moritz is such a fascinating director. He's an amazing dramaturg. The two of them worked so well together. And Rob, I gotta say this about Rob, we had such a hit at EST, and then we did it again like 6 weeks later. Rob never sat on his laurels. And Arthur Kopic came to see the show a couple weeks ago, and we talked about that, because it's very difficult for a writer who's respected and has success, and wow, that was a hit, to make significant changes.
Uh-huh.
There are scenes that were cut. I had a scene with a pastor that was cut. Big, big changes. Every incarnation, we did it twice at EST, then we did it at MCC.
Right.
And now we've done it on Broadway. And Rob had real courage to be different. And I remember Steve and I were talking about it recently, because the ending of the play changed significantly between Marjorie.
Really?
And, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did it end before?
Well, I wasn't injured before. And we used to talk about Dad. And I will tell you that. We talked about Dad a lot. And they cut these lines out. And Steve just had a fit. And he was so afraid to change and so committed to what we had. And I said, no, nobody gives a shit about Dad. Dad is dead. He's the symptom. You and I are the disease. We're the people that have to heal. And Rob and Moritz fought for it. There was a lot of fighting for what you believe in. When we went to MCC,
That was the first off-Broadway production, right?
That was the first off-Broadway. They decided to cut the epilogue.
Oh.
And we were all unhappy about it. Moritz and Rob tried to convince the producers that we needed it. Steve wrote, I think, a 3-page essay explaining what that meant and why we needed the epilogue. Got put back in. And then I will tell you, that was, what, in 2014? You know, we're 2 weeks into the previews. And Steve says, oh, my gosh, I just figured it out today. The epilogue is the continuation. It's just Tyrone. He's still speaking. You're the one that fought for it, and you didn't understand. We knew that. But that's what I mean, is you keep discovering. Rob's writing is so tight and so specific that you can learn something new every day.
How was it for you when you found out you were taking this play to Broadway?
I'm surprised I'm not crying when you say that. You know, every incarnation.
How did you find out?
Well, MCC, I didn't know they were going to take me, and then you cry about that and you're excited.
So you thought you might be replaced?
I was certain I was going to be replaced.
Really?
I had no faith whatsoever. Both times. That's how terrible I am.
Wow.
I fantasize in specifics, but I'm a realist. And I never thought it would happen. I really didn't. Kevin McCullum is our lead producer.
Yeah.
Goddamn genius.
And he's just, you know, Mark talked about him a lot, but he's sort of known to be the producer that takes chances on productions, on actors, on...
Rent.
Yeah, exactly.
Drowsy Chaperone.
Right.
In the Heights.
Yes.
I mean, this guy, title of show.
Yes.
He just believes in taking risks. And, you know, it's astounding. I mean, I didn't know until the night before they announced.
That it was transferring?
No, that I was in it.
Oh, wait, hang on. What didn't you know?
I didn't know I was in it.
Oh my! But you know how you knew it was going.
I'm
going
to tell actors because one day I want to write a book about how it all breaks down.
Yeah.
You don't know. They call and say, "Are you available?" Everybody who checks your availability does not mean you have a job. And you know what you want. And you know I wanted a humidifier and a vocal coach. That's what I wanted. And I didn't get my contract until the night before.
So you knew it was transferring, but you didn't know if you were in it.
Yes. None of us knew. You kind of know when it's a final offer, and you just wait it out. But there were like 3 weeks in between that final offer. And so you just don't know. And you just – my husband is amazing for that. He's always like, you don't have it until you have it, and you let go. And when I got upset because I thought I wasn't going to move, he said, great, you already cried. You already cried about it. You don't have to cry again. You're done.
Yeah.
You did your crying. You just don't know until you know. And as an actor, it's a hard thing that you can count on nothing. Which is, again, why the be happy where you are is really important.
Yeah.
I had a great guy, Christopher Gorman. He used to be the head of casting at CBS. I did a summer workshop with him. And he said, I'm going to give you the best advice you're ever going to hear, you know, how to make it. He said, work on yourself. If you've got a drug problem, go to rehab. If you're an alcoholic, go to AA. Be as healthy as you can. If you're messed up, go to therapy. Take care of yourself and be ready. Be healthy and happy, and always do art that you believe in. Don't pick a showcase because you got a six-pack and you think maybe you're going to get a TV show from your six-pack. He said, if you don't believe in the work itself, don't do it. Only do things you believe in. Don't worry about getting paid, because when you're ready, we will come and find you. And believe me, I heard that how many years ago? 14?
Yeah.
So I would lose faith, but I would always think, I'm ready when they give me the job. And I always only did things I believe in. Hand to God, I did it for 9 months at EST. My W-2 was $3,200.
Oh, my God.
I spent my savings account.
Of course.
We were hoping it was going to move. I couldn't do my commercials, which is how I earned my living. I couldn't be out. We didn't have understudies. But if you believe in it, that's all that matters. And when I thought, oh, I'm not going to go forward, and I'm going to get emotional, it didn't matter because the job itself was so amazing. That's what you have to tell actors. Don't do stuff to try to get the next job. This is your job.
Yeah.
It's not about the money. It's not about how much you earn. It's just about making this piece of beauty that you can offer to people today.
I love you. I want to end on talking about something really happy, which was that you got nominated for a Tony Award.
My God.
Did you wake up really early and watch the Tony Award nominations?
I did.
Oh, I'm so glad. I love it when people, I hate it when people are like, no, I was asleep.
No,
and my agent called
asleep.
Me. And no offense to anybody who said that. Sleep. Get your beauty sleep.
Yeah, get your, no, but, listen, I did not think it was the slightest possibility. You know, there'd been some gossip.
You didn't?
No. No, the only thing I read was, you know, Geneva Carr, the dark horse, might eke out a nomination. And so I lived on that dream all day. And, you know, my best friends aren't in the business.
They're, yeah.
You know, so I couldn't brag and say, I'm a dark horse that might eke out, you know.
A nomination.
I remember living in the fantasy. And that night when I went to bed with my husband, I said, oh, I don't want to go to bed. And he said, why? And I said, it's been this possibility all day. And now the day's over. So we went to bed a little late because I just didn't want to give up the dream, but it was done. I knew that when I went to bed, it was done. And he tossed and turned all night, and he sleeps like a log.
Uh-huh.
So it was like at 8:30, so he was like, knock, knock, 8 o'clock, moving me on the shoulder. Come on, let's get up. Make me breakfast. So I make her breakfast, spinach, feta, eggs. It's Patrick. We're eating our breakfast, and we're watching, and it's alphabetical. So Geneva Carr... We screamed.
Oh, my God.
We both started crying. He's Japanese. He's not a crier. We could not believe. I mean, it was just screaming and jumping up and down. And then within minutes, your phone explodes.
Your life just
your
changes.
Facebook. Well, I think I got about 800 messages.
Oh, my God.
I mean, everybody you've ever known wishes you well. everybody. It's amazing. And within an hour, I had to hire Lisa Goldberg.
Yeah.
Who has changed my life and become one of my best friends.
She's the best.
She's a publicist who gets it, who cares about you.
She likes sports a lot, which is weird to me, but whatever.
She's a very interesting woman.
Yeah.
But then I'll tell you about getting ready for the Tonys, because that woman is like... She just had a whip. She gave me 20 minutes to get ready.
Because people might not know, you have a show that day.
Oh, yeah. The Tonys, you have a show that day. We had one at 3 o'clock. So the red carpet starts at 6. You are done at 5:15. We come off stage at 5:15. Hair and makeup people are there. And they are literally working in tandem. I wasn't even facing a mirror. Then you borrow diamonds. It's very exciting. They bring diamonds to you in the morning, and you get to just pick out $160,000 worth of diamonds.
Are you serious?
There was a big security guard that came with a lady, and I said, oh, is he going to be coming with me to the Tonys? And she said, no, you're on your own. So, these people are getting, I didn't even look in the mirror. And I said, am I good? And Lisa, 20 minutes. She was like, you have to make that red carpet.
Yeah. Because
then you have to get in a car. I had to wear 5.5-inch heels to fit in the dress.
Oh my God.
So I get in the car, and then you've got to take 3 blocks, but it takes forever. You show up and you do just a line of interviews. It's
that red carpet was insane year. And it was cool because they had, for the first time, the TonyAwards.com or whatever was doing like a red carpet thing with Sierra Bajas and Laura Osnes, where they were doing interviews. You looked amazing.
It took a village. Yeah. Let me tell you, it took a village.
It doesn't seem like it would be that hard with you.
Oh, you make calls. Listen, the guy who did my hair, Ryan Cotton, is like superstar, Jennifer Aniston, Emma Roberts. He does all
that.
And I did hair shows for him about 15 years ago. So I said, hey, would you do my hair?
Oh, my God. Wait, so how was the experience of being at the Tonys?
Oh, my God. It was absolutely amazing. Some people have said it's not fun. I'm going to tell you right now, it is unbelievable fun. First of all, you go down that red carpet at the beginning, so people see you drive up. It's kind of exciting. And then you see people like Brian D'Arcy James. And then you see movie stars, and you see theater actors, and you see everybody you've wanted to see. And you talk for the last time to all those people that have been wishing you well during the 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's magical and fun, and they're taking pictures, and you just get to live it up. You go inside. You see people that you haven't seen in years, people you've auditioned for, people you wish you could audition for, and they're saying hello. Thank God they did my category first. I hadn't prepared a speech because I knew Helen was going to win.
I really thought you were going to win. I really did. I really, really thought you were going to win.
Well, listen, the fact you saying that is my win.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in the interviews, they're like, oh, do you have a speech? And I was like, no, Helen Mirren's winning. I don't have a speech. And then I'm sitting there, and thank God it was first, because I thought, what if I do win? So I didn't know until the next day that Bradley Cooper had read the category.
Oh, really?
That's how nervous I was.
Oh, my God. Did you have, like, an amazing seat? Were you, like, right in the...
I had an amazing seat. Well, first of all, I was, like, 5 seats down, farther back from Helen, who was in the first row. So yeah. I was, like, 7 seats back. First commercial break, I ran up to her, and I was like, Helen, hey, do you mind if I get a selfie? The Hollywood Reporter is following me. Sure. So she and her husband are in the photo, and... I guess I was nervous and I didn't know it. My hand is so high up on Taylor Hackford's thigh. I don't know what the hell I thought I was doing. I'm like posing my hand like it's an armrest, but it's pretty high up on his thigh. I don't know what the hell I was thinking.
Did you get to have a lot of FaceTime with Helen Mirren over the months?
Yeah, she is. That woman is a class act. Class. In every interview, she was darling and kind and thoughtful. And in pictures, she said, oh, now, Tyrone, how do I hold my hand? Oh, like this. Oh, Tyrone. Well, so she wins, obviously. I knew she was going to win, thank God. So the minute I see her at the first after party, I run up to her and I say, Helen, oh, God. Listen, I'm just so happy for you. Congratulations. It's so deserved. And she says, oh, darling, it's nomination. It's really the nomination. It's so wonderful. That's really about the nomination. It's such an honor. And I said, you bitch, you won. But I said, being mentioned in the same breath as you is the highlight of my life. And then, of course, she's like, oh, your dress. And I'm like, your dress. She is, first of all, that was, what night were the Tonys? Sunday. Her first night off was Wednesday. She came to see our show. First night she was free, and she's the only one I care about. And everyone knew not to tell me because my birthday was right after the nominations. And I had met Helen. And Helen, I was like, Helen, it's Geneva Carr. And she, congrats, enjoy every moment. And I was like, I hope you see the show. And she said, oh, I'm coming on a Wednesday night. So my birthday, I think, Helen's here. The company manager said, hey, do you like to know when celebrities are here? And I said, no. And then the whole show, I thought, Helen loves this. Oh, that scene was good. Helen saw it. It was Jesse Tyler Ferguson, which was wonderful. But so she did finally, the first day after the Tonys, she and her husband came, and gracious, kind, funny. I mean, you want to talk about the whole package? Sexy, generous. Yeah. It's just, that is a true star to me. And then I'll give you a little secret about her. One of our subs on the crew, he said, I said, oh, what have you been doing? Because, you know, he hadn't been around. And he said, oh, I was subbing over at the audience. And I said, how is it? And he said, great. That lady, man, she's the real deal. That Helen's a real deal. Apparently, after the Tonys, she said to everyone, and I mean everyone, the cast, the crew, the box office, she's having a party, and she said, I want you all to come to my house for a lovely party, a barbecue. And he said, oh, I'm just subbing for so-and-so. And she said, oh, well, then you're subbing at the party. You were invited.
Oh, my God.
So she had a big party for I mean, come on.
I know. That's...
And to, you know, to give it to me as if I won when we know she did. My fantasy is that I get to work with her one day because everybody who's worked with her says it.
Geneva Carr, I love you so much. I am so happy to meet you. I have loved having you on this show. Hopefully you'll come back and see us again.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
You're the best. Bye.
Hey, theater people, time to make good on another Kickstarter reward. This one is a special message which comes to us from Miss Stephanie Dryden. Here goes. Happy birthday, Louise Ashley Ryan. Thank you for your incredible friendship. You are always there for me, and your bubbly personality always brings light to my day. I hope your birthday is amazing, just like you. Love, Stephanie. On a personal note, I, Patrick, want to say that Louise Ryan is one of our most loyal and enthusiastic listeners, so please indulge me here. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Louise Ashley Ryan. Happy birthday to you. Thanks, girl. We love you. Theater People is produced by me and Mike Jensen. Mike edited this episode. Special thanks, as always, to Steve Tipton, Bradley Behan, our webmaster, Keith Rainwater, Eric Emch, who is the amazing guy behind our new logo design, which is coming very soon, Ellen Marie Marsh, and the staff at Oswald's. Theater People is listener-supported, and that is thanks in part to Molly Meader, Michelle Sterling, Wendy Rickstein, Jennifer Rubin, Laura Copenhaver, Gina Mizell, Hannah Wasserman, Jeremy Ween, and Mike Noland. Hi, Mike. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, tell your friends about us. Let's get the theater community talking.